So let me tell you the topics I was thinking of doing. Because my mandate, as I understand it, for this class is supposed to be loops, but I can make it anything at this point because I haven't actually committed myself to what I'm going to talk about. So let me put some topics down, and then I'd like to get us some feedback as to whether or not this is going to be what you need to see. So, because I can still adjust things a little bit depending on what you're. So the mandate I was told was that is that you're looking for a class on loop effect, loops for normalization. Topics that you don't see in a first pass in field theory. So the topics, let me say potential topics had in mind were, so it was just, I guess the first thing would be, loop, and I mean essentially it's always going to morally be one loop calculations. And that would be for scattering and for Green's functions. Second thing would be then that leads to renormalization. So once you then in there would be the renormalization group. Three would be BPHZ, and I can't remember who those people are, but that's basically the thing which is why regularization doesn't really matter, why all regularizations are equally good. Topic four was going to be non-renormalizable getting a little bit of annoying noise there. If you guys in Guelph can, is that you guys or someone else?
No,
that's what we're hearing is the hallway, maybe, yeah. Analyzable theories and effective field theory. Five would be LSZ reduction. This is the connection between Green functions. Six would be Lehmann-Shalane representation. Seven will be the Bloch Nordsieg. So that could be pair production. And that was kind of more or less where I pooped out. And I was going to use as much as possible, use QED as the example. So, are any of those topics things that you have feel like you've already covered and don't need to cover again? Or are they all sufficiently? Can you guys see the board over there?
Yep.
Okay. So the presumption is that you're completely happy doing tree-level calculations. So if someone handed you a Grandin, like QED or scalar QED, and said calculate comp and scattering, you could just go off and do it and come back with the answer, and you're happy with that. Is that true for everybody? So I take silence as being a saying approval. So okay, so in that case, this will be the plan. We may not get through all this. My mandate was to do loops for normalization, and then special topics kind of things like these things like the LSC reduction and the Lehmann-Shillain representation are exact results in the sense that they're spectral representations of Green's function that you can then evaluate in perturbation theory if you like. All right, so you're happy with that? And for the people enrolled in the class, the way I thought I'd do the marking scheme was essentially assignments. And maybe one of those assignments could be a take-home exam or something like that. So, because we're supposed to make this into a course, a course with real marks to it. So the so I thought maybe 30% take-home final, and then 70% assignments or something like that. Because I think the only way to really learn field theory is to do it. And you can hear people talk about field theory as much as you like, and it doesn't sink in until you actually do it. So so the final would be in April. And I'm not sure when all the university's terms end, but I'm assuming it's early April is when classes would normally end. Is that true in Guelph too?
Yeah.
OK. So somewhere in April, we could do the final. And to start that off, the first assignment I wanted to write down, maybe next time. I'd like to get you off smoke you out on tree level things. I wanted you to calculate a few scattering properties at tree level, I want you to be using a notation that's similar to the notation I'm going to use in class. And make sure we're all on the same page notationally. So the most important thing you're going to learn in this class is that there's a right metric and a wrong metric. And the right metric is mostly plus. And if you use the wrong metric, then you fail. And so that's going to drive other choices. That means that the gamma matrices, when we get to the Dirac equation, our gamma matrices are going to be the same as they always would be. But because of the signs here, if you're used to minus, plus, 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 or minus, plus, minus, minus, minus metric, then your gamma matrices are going to be differing from mine by a factor of I. So by and large, I'm going to use gamma lower 0 will be 0, I, 0, where these are 2 by 2 blocks. Then gamma space is going to be 0, 0, and I never get the sign right. A is 1, 2, and 3 for the three spatial directions, and sigmas are the Pauli matrices. Sigma 1 is 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma 2 is 0, minus I, 0. Sigma 3 is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And this is the basis for which gamma 5, which is I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 is just 1, 0, 0, minus 1, where again, these are 2 by 2 blocks. And the convention I'm using is that this is, top is left-handed, bottom is right-handed. So gamma 5 has eigenvalue plus 1 on left-handed spinners and minus 1 on right-handed spinners. So I don't know how much, I'm thinking that you're happy with the Dirac equation, you're happy with the statement of what the gamma HTs are. Nothing I'm saying here is outrageous except for maybe the conventions I'm using compared to what you're used to. But there's nothing conceptual about what I'm saying here which is bothering anybody. Is that all right? All right. I guess the other procedural things are, if you're looking for books, or other references, I'm not going to really follow any books. But it's always good to have some to look at if you want other points of view. So the classics, which are not necessarily the best ones to work from, but which you'll always learn something if you read them, are Weinberg's Field Theory books, volumes 1 and 2. And then Peskin and Schrader is the wrong metric, but it's otherwise pretty good. And I've never actually looked at this one, but I'm told that the book by Sredniski is actually good. Then the older guard books, so these are the more modern books. The older books, there's an old classic is, it's kind of actually encyclopedic more than classic. Hitzig and Zuber. They're all called quantum field theory or something like that. There's an old book by Ramond on path integrals. And then there's a really old book by Lourier. There's a classic book on the standard model, which is a great stocking stuffer, and you should all buy it. And buy one for your mother as well, by me. And so the conventions that I use are going to be the same as this, except I'm normalizing the states a little bit differently than in that book. This is me and Guy Moore. So you're never required to get anything out of those books, but if what I'm actually going to be following it, to the extent I follow anything, it'll be this for conventions and Weinberg for various pieces of the QED setup. All right, so I think that's all the procedural things. Are you all happy with Mandelstam variables, too, for scattering? You know, S, T, and U? Anybody not happy? All right. Good. All right, so any questions about anything like that? That's more or less all the procedural things I was going to start off with. All right. So then to start off with, what I was going to do is today probably just lay out, my conventions for free fields, just because we're going to be using them over and over and over again. And I want to be explicit about having written it once. And the second reason for doing the free fields explicitly is that when it comes time to renormalize stuff, there's conventional choices that you make when you write a free Lagrangian down. And some of the renormalizations you do are to do with remaking those choices. And the choices that you make about when you write your free Lagrangian in canonical form, you've used field redefinitions to put yourself into canonical form. And once you do loops, you tend to ruin the choices you made, so you have to remake them. And one of those choices is a normalization choice. And so the word renormalization is coming from the fact that you're renormalizing the fields again to fix problems that you've introduced because quantum corrections have changed the normalizations of what you start off with. So let's start off with free fields. And I want to do spins 0, a half, and 1. And I'm never going to do anything in this class about Hardin spin 1. And the nice thing about these fields is that if we're going to stick to renormalizable theories, which I'll get to in a bit, it's you can write down in one line essentially what the most general theory is. And so it's a very broad class of theories, but not so broad that it's impossible to deal with. And it includes all the interesting ones, like the QED and the standard model and similar things. So let's start off with that. All right, so I guess I should also start with an aside. So before talking about free fields, the reason we're talking about free fields is that we're ultimately, in this class, doing perturbation theory, and the loops are a particular order in perturbation theory. And so we're imagining that we've got a Lagrangian, which is a free Lagrangian, plus an interaction Lagrangian. And in practice, we're thinking this is something which is quadratic, or less, in the fields. And this is something which is cubic and higher. And that's just because in the case when this is quadratic, the field equations are linear. We can solve them. We can explicitly diagonalize the Hamiltonian. We can do everything we want to do as a quantum theory. And then we're going to just imagine perturbing in this interaction everywhere. And so to start off the story, I want to write out what this is going to look like. And then I want to, when it comes time to write down the interactions, there's a set of rules for what the interactions have to satisfy. And I just want to list the rules. I think these are rules that you've seen, but I want to just be explicit about them so that we're all on the same page. And then we're good to go. So so let me start with the rules, I guess. So like motherhood criterion for field theories. What do we have to demand of our Lagrangian? We want it to be, we want time evolution, which is going to be e to the minus I ht, to be unitary. And so that means we want h to be Hermitian. And since h is being built from L, the Lagrangian, the honest to God Lagrangian, is the integral d3x of the Lagrangian density, little l. And then h is built from L in the way you normally would build Hamiltonians. And so that's going to mean that we want L to be also Hermitian. That's one thing we want to ask. We want to have it to be local. So that's the statement here that the Lagrangian is the integral d3x of something which depends only on x. And it all depends at the same x, is that's coming from the base, ultimately that comes from cluster decomposition. What you expect is independent events, probabilities for independent events should factorize, and the physical criterion is that your things that are separated in space at a given time should be independent. So amplitudes and probabilities should factorize independent events. And spatially separated things so outside the light cone things events dependent. So if we do scattering on the Earth and we do some of the scattering at Mars, then the amplitudes for whatever happens is the product of the Earth amplitude and the Mars amplitude. And this is related to the locality because, you know, you make some, this is a statement about how what states do. That says that states should come as products of things, and correlation functions should all separate as you separate the positions at which they're evaluated. But when you evolve things forward in time, a local form, you know, if the Lagrangian is essentially a sum over different positions at a given time, and the time evolution is the exponential of that, essentially, then that's going to guarantee that the evolution is coming to you with each time, essentially, you know, the different positions are factorizing in the sense that that we have the exponential of a sum over different positions. That means the time evolution is the product of things at a given position. And so once you've made things factorize at a given time, locality in the Lagrangian is what guarantees that time evolution doesn't screw up that property as time goes on. And so it's these criterion that are kind of underlying this condition. That's what else we want to have? We want to have Lorentz invariants, or Poincaré invariants. So we want Lorentz invariants and translation invariants. And in practice, that says that that the Lagrangian should depend on position and time. You know, the translation part says that it depends on position and time only through fields, not through explicit functions of position and time. And the Lorentz invariance part of it, given that we're going to do an integral, is going to basically say that L should be a Lorentz scalar. So that the action, let's call it action, which is the integral dt of L, is the integral d4x of Lagrangian density will be invariant. Do you want to, are you going to be able to see there? Okay. There's more space over here if you want to. If you want to pull up here. So we're going to ask for that to be true, but as you probably know from your first field theory courses, that's not quite sufficient. That if you, this all sounds very reasonable, that if you made things Lorentz scalars, the action would be invariant, and it might have been a little bit of a surprise that you had to talk about the action rather than the Hamiltonian. Normally, you're thinking of the Hamiltonian commuting with something is what makes it a symmetry. That can't be true for Lorentz transformations, because there you're actually, you know that the energy changes under Lorentz transformation, so. So the reason we talk about Lagrangians, one of the reasons, is that the action being invariant is the thing that's building in the nice properties of Lorentz invariants. And so there's a very simple statement of what the criterion is for Lorentz invariants in terms of the Lagrangian density. But it's not sufficient. It's a necessary condition. And that's because if you think about, so there's another condition, which is we have to ask that the fields commute at different space-time. If they're separated at different positions at the same time, they have to commute or anti-commute if they're if we're talking about fermions. And this condition is kind of also required in order to get Lorentz invariance. And one way to see that is that you know, the S matrix comes to you as a in perturbation theory. It's 1 plus the matrix element of or it comes to you as a sum of terms, and the generic thing in that sum involves, you know, the time ordered or the final state. You're taking alpha scatters to beta, let's say, the final state inside some time ordered product of the, you know, of the Hamiltonian density, x1, xn. And one of the things you do when you derive scattering in field theory is you derive some sort of a statement like this, where if you give me the Hamiltonian density, there'll be integrals, you know, d4x1 and so on, 4xn. And there's factors of 1 over n factorial and stuff like that. But the important thing is that what comes to you is an expression involving the time-ordered product. Now that time ordering makes sense if you have if you take two positions x1 and x2 that are space that are time-like separated, so they're within one's within the like cone of the other one. Say this is x1, and here's x2. Then everybody agrees on what the ordering of those things are in time. But this time ordering is a problem if this is x1, and x2 is over here, then it doesn't act. There's no physically absolute ordering, which makes sense because depending on who the observer is. Some observers will see that earlier than this, and other observers will see this one earlier than that. And there's no, you know, right or wrong answer as to who's first and who's second if you're space-like separated. So this time ordering story is giving you a Lorentz invariant S matrix as long as you don't have to care what the ordering is when these things are separated by space-like distances. And so that's why you have to require that the Hamiltonian commutes at space-like separations, because then you don't care what the ordering is. And so, since the Hamiltonian is being built in the fields, you're effectively requiring the fields to satisfy that property. And so that's kind of where this causality condition comes from. And that's actually the condition with all the juice in it for quantum field theory, because that's where things like the CPT theorem and the existence of antiparticles and all those things come from. I want to write on this, but I don't know if I'm writing on a board or if I'm just the wall.
No, it is a board.
It is a board? Okay. So the reason that's such a powerful condition, so causality is powerful because if you said, well, what are the fields that you're building things out of? We're building things out of fields that were, I kind of wrote them as if they were localized at some specific point. But the operators, the basic operators that you're talking about in quantum field theory are the things that create particles, the creation and annihilation operators. And they're labeled by the things that label your particle states, like momentum. So the basic operators are destruction and creation operators, where if you act on the no particle state, you get a particle state. And that's, say, the momentum. And that might be spin and any other label you think a particle should have. So when you say how things transform, when you label your particles, you're labeling things using conserved things. So if you're not dealing with a translation invariant problem, you might not have momentum here. But you're going to choose things that are conserved that you can label your particle states with. And that's not the labels. So fields, you know, you're never choosing position as one of your labels of particles, because that's something which is not conserved. Whereas your fields want to be labeled by positions if you want to make local Lagrangians out of them. And so you're naturally led to trying to build your Hamiltonian L and H want to be built from the Fourier transform of these things. So you're led to be considering things like A of X and T, which would be some integral d3p of some coefficient u of p sigma. Maybe you might have to sum over the particle labels ap sigma e to the I px. And if you're doing this in the Heisenberg representation, then you'd have a time dependence. Depending on what representation you use, the time dependence is either an A or it's not an A, but let's say it's not an A. So the thing that you'd actually be using over there in your Hamiltonian or your Lagrangian would be something like this, because it's something which is referring to a position. This coefficient here is some known thing, and it's a group theory problem to find out what it is. And so the story that you normally learn in the first year in your first quantum field theory course is, if you're doing a Lorentz invariant, if you're doing a relativistic field theory, you know how these things transform under Lorentz transformations. And particles transform the way states, the creation operators transform the way particle states transform. And so they transform under unitary representations of the Lorentz group. And those are all infinite dimensional. On the other hand, the fields transform under finite dimensional representations of the Lorentz group because you only have a finite number of fields. So there might be a scalar, or it might be a spinner, or it might be a vector. What is it? Representation of Lorentz group. And this is a unitary, this transforms as a unitary representation. So they're different. And so these are basically the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that take you from one to the other. You're writing one representation in terms of sums of the other representations. And because of that, group theory tells you what they are up to normalization. So the coefficients that you would write in the expansion of a field in terms of its creation and relation operators are dictated to you by Lorentz transformations only. And I'm not going to write them down for what I'm going to say now, but of course we will write them down in a second for the particles of interest. But that problem was solved in the 60s as to what you give me a particle of any given spin, you give me a field of any given Lorentz transformation property, then it's known what these things are for any choice that you make. And all the ones for any given particle, all the different fields that represent any given particle are related to each other by taking derivatives of one another. So it's not like there's more than one way. There's no physics in choosing the field that describes your particles. But the problem is that once you've done this, and since there's no options on what this is, you can just calculate what the commutator of A is at different space-like separations, and it's not zero. So the problem that you hit is, problem, if I just take that and I calculate, you know, a of x t, a of y t at space-like separations, that's not equal to zero, it's just something. And so the only way that you can actually make something which is causal is you have to actually not do what I told you to do here. This is what you would have done in a non-relativistic field theory. You would have written things in terms of creation and destruction operators. What you have to do is to get fields which commute at space-like separations, what you need to do is you define your field to be this field, A, plus another field, the creation part of the, so the complex conjugate of another field, with some phase, potentially. Let's write it as a phase, e to the I, alpha. So where B is just some other thing involving some other particles. So it's a sum over spins, integral d3p, of some wave function, u of p sigma, times the destruction operator for that particle. And if this particle has the same mass, if B is a particle with the same mass as the one you got from A, then B won't commute with itself at space-like separations. A won't compute with itself at space-like separations. But you can make their failure to commute cancel the failure of A to B with commute in such a way that that phi does commute at space-like separations. So then, and that only works if this is a phase. So if then phi of x t phi of y t can be zero, and this is what you mean by an antiparticle. So it says that for every particle you have, there has to be an antiparticle which has the same mass, which couples everywhere in exactly the same way, because when phi appears in the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian, A and B are always appearing at most separated in normalization by a phase, and they're appearing the same way everywhere. And that's the thing that tells you that antiparticles exist. That's the thing that tells you why CPT has to be a symmetry. That's the thing that tells you why crossing symmetry is true, the fact that particles and antiparticles have no relative normalizations in their strength of interactions. All those things are a consequence of this causality requirement. So that was that's why you demand it to be true. And then I want to make sure I haven't forgotten anything here. I guess you also have to demand stability. If I go back to our list here, that was a big aside on that was an aside on what our criterion are. Let me. Is that a board?
Looks like board.
It feels like paint though, so that's I'm hesitant to write on it.
Can I see the one that's underneath?
This one here?
No, underneath that one over there.
This one here?
Underneath that, yeah.
Okay, maybe I can pull this one down. All the way down. Put that one up.
Thanks.
Okay, so if I go back to the list of things we want our theories to satisfy, what are we at now? Causality was 4. So 5 would be stability. So we want our Hamiltonian basically to be bounded below. What else do we have to ask? That's probably it. So if we're going to focus on the free part of the Hamiltonian, then we ask for the L to be quadratic at most in the field, 5x. But that's, of course, nothing which is fundamental. It's just because that's what we mean by the free part. So so I told you that story because now we can just write down what these fields are. So what I'll do is for spin 0, spin 1/2, and spin 1, you can write down what these Clebsch-Gordan coefficients would have been. And there's an interesting story there for spin 1. I don't know to what extent this was emphasized when you did the first quantum field theory. But if you ask the question, if I have a massless spin 1 particle, and I ask what fields can I use to represent it in this way, it's a Clebsch-Gordan problem, so that it won't always be true that the U's will exist. If you give me some random, if you tried to represent a spin 1 particle or a spin 15 particle with a scalar field, for instance, then you'll find that the only solution for U is 0, that there's no non-trivial Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. In the same way that if I take spin 1/2 and spin 1/2, the product of those two things is a representation of the rotation group, and that decomposes as a spin 1 and a spin 0, but not a spin 15. So there's some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are 0 if the transformation doesn't go. And so if you have a massless spin 1 particle, and you have if you tried to represent it with a vector field, you might have thought that would be something which has a solution. You can find what U is. And that one of the surprises is, when you do this, is that actually does not have a solution. That you can't represent a massless spin 1 particle by a vector field, which is kind of paradoxical, because you're thinking that, you know, you're used to using spin 1 particles like, or vector fields like electromagnetic potentials to describe spin 1 particles like photons. And what's happening is that the smallest field you can describe a spin 1 particle, a massless spin 1 particle with, is an antisymmetric tensor field. And this kind of an argument will take you to basically the field strength, F mu nu, and the thing you'd find here would be you'd find the field F mu nu, you know, equal to minus F mu nu, would be the field that would be the smallest one that represents a spin, massless spin 1 particle. And what would be playing the role of U would be something like momentum mu, polarization vector nu minus momentum nu, polarization vector mu. And so you'd find that this thing, oh, that's the curl of something. If I defined A mu to be the integral D3P sum over polarizations of epsilon mu times AP e to the I PX. And so you might think, well, so now I've contradicted myself. I told you can't find a vector field which will represent a massless spin 1 particle. What you instead find is an antisymmetric tensor field, which you learn is the curl of something. So then why isn't the thing at the curl of something which is the vector field that I said that you couldn't have? What happens is if you do a transformation, the assumption that was impossible to satisfy was to have this thing be transformed like a vector field and this thing transform like a massless spin 1 particle. If you just take this thing and ask how does it transform under Lorentz transformations, you can do that because you know what all these things are as functions of momentum. And what happens is that A is not a vector. It's a vector only up to a gauge transformation. It's a vector up to the addition of a gradient of something. And so this is a tensor because adding a gradient of something to A cancels in F. But A is not a vector. It's only a vector up to a gauge transformation. And that kind of shows you why gauge invariance is going to be built in as a, it's often presented as a separate assumption beyond Lorentz invariant and quantum mechanics. But really, Lorentz invariance is forcing you to build in gauge invariance because the thing you're building your Lagrangian out of, if you make a Lagrangian that's a Lorentz scalar out of A, thinking that A was a vector, you haven't succeeded because A is not a vector. It's only a vector up to a gauge transformation. So for the Lagrangian to be really Lorentz invariant, if it's made out of A, it has to not only be made, you have to make it like a Lorentz scalar, but you have to also do it in a way which is independent, where A goes to A plus the gradient hasn't any effect. And so it also has to be gauge invariant. So there's a story there I'm not going to tell, but I wanted to say it because it's not always presented, and you should know that it's true. And so I'll just write down the answer. So I'll write down what A is, and I'll write down what F is. But you should know that the logic that you would use is that it's a Clebsch-Gordan problem. You know how particles transform under Lorentz transformations. You know how fields transform under Lorentz transformations. That tells you what these U's are up to normalization. And then sometimes they're zero, in which case if that field cannot be used to describe that particle, and sometimes they're not. And when they're not, you know what they are. And the one surprise that you hit normally is that the mass of spin 1 particles are not allowed to be represented by vectors, but they are allowed to be represented by anisometric tensors. And your usual story of using a vector is not really quite a vector. It's a vector only up to gauge transformations. And that's why gauge invariance is going to be important when you do QED. Right, so that's the end of the aside. So now what I'd like to do now is just write down the most general Lagrangian and free Lagrangian involving spin 0 particles, spin 1/2 particles, spin 1 particles, to make explicit the redefinitions that you do to put them in standard form. And that at face value, we're going to have a lot of parameters in these Lagrangians if you write down the most general quadratic Lagrangian. And you know that what we should be looking for as the physical parameters would be the masses of the particles we're talking about and the energy maybe of the vacuum. And that's really it for free particles. And that's not a lot of parameters compared to what it's going to look like we have. And the resolution of that paradox is that there's a lot of freedom to redefine the fields. Nothing physical depends on what variables you use to describe the physics. So doing field redefinitions doesn't change anything physically. So any parameters you can remove by doing field redefinitions aren't playing any physical role, so you might as well remove them. So that process of going through the canonical form where you've removed the irrelevant parameters, I'm just kind of laboring, which you might have taken for granted, because we'll have to redo it again when we quantize, when we do the loop corrections. So we need a board here now. Let's do this
guy. Just a question about your conventions. Normally, for the momentum integrals, you need like a factor of 2e or something like that.
Yeah.
Are you including that in your use? Is that the
I've been vague yet. When I actually write one down, you'll see what I mean. And I'm not going to use the, I have to apologize because I'm not going to use the conventions of the book. I'm kind of more or less now following the first chapter of this book. But Guy made me use conventions that were not really mine. So I'm going to actually use, if I start using those conventions, I'm going to get it wrong at some point. So I'm going to use the ones I was brought up with. And it's all to do with how you normalize, are your momentum eigenstates normalized the way they were in high school, or are you putting in some fancy covariant normalization? And I never learned the fancy covariant normalization. But when I do that, I'll be forced to be explicit then where all these energies go. And that's part of what I'm writing this all out explicitly, is to be explicit about that. All right, so N-free scalar fields. So what can we write down if we have, we have a bunch of fields phi of x and t, and we have more than one of them. So let's say we have phi a, or a from 1 to n. And we're going to be thinking that, I'll come back to that later. So what's the most general quadratic Lagrangian we can write down involving finest derivatives. We also have d mu. I'm sure you're going to be happy with it. Just d dx mu. So what can we write down? We could have something independent of the field. So that would be. Unfortunately, the way I'm thinking about this normally, I do the derivatives first. But let's do the derivatives first. So we could have minus aij times d mu phi I, or say aab mu phi a d mu phi b. So that's something with one derivative or two derivatives. We could have something with more derivatives. But I'm going to put that aside for a second. I could have things with no derivatives. So I could have minus b, ab, phi a, phi b. I could have things with one, you know, I could have had, I guess, minus c, a. Minus d. What else could I have? I could have minus e, a, b, phi a, d mu, phi b. Plus higher derivatives. Did I miss anything? So we're not going to do higher derivatives. And if you ask why, it was because of the stability criterion. If you add, and this is a good exercise for you to go do, is if you add something with second derivatives of phi in the Lagrangian, and you calculate the energy by using the, you know, the canonical procedure of figuring out what the, if you have more than first derivatives in time in your Lagrangian, then you need to generalize the way you would normally define the Hamiltonian. Normally what you would have done is you would have defined the momentum to be the derivative of the action with respect to the time derivative of the field. And then in the Hamiltonian problem, you would have said, well, instead of evolving phi forward in time with a second order field equation, where I have to specify initial positions and velocities at the initial time, you would have instead said, well, I have to evolve phi and its momenta forward in time, where I specify the momentum and the positions at the initial time as initial data. That changes if you have second time derivatives, because then your equations of motion are not second order in time, they're higher order in time. And so you have to specify higher derivatives as part of the initial data. So you have to specify, say, the second derivative at the initial time to have a well-defined evolution. And so in the canonical procedure, what you do is you define new variable, say EA would be the derivative with respect to phi dot dot A, and so on. And then in the canonical procedure, you'd have to involve, your problem would be to evolve phi, pi, and E forward in time, where you specify all three of them at the initial time. And which is the way, that's the way the canonical procedure learns that there's more initial data that you have to specify. If you do this thing, what you find is that if you turn the crank and find what the Hamiltonian is, there's it leads you to a result which is linear in these new variables. And so the basic observation that stops you from talking about higher derivative actions is that if you have a Hamiltonian that's linear in one of the variables, it can't be bounded from below, because you can just make that variable as large as you like, fix all the other ones, and you can make it as negative as you like in one direction or the other. Not bounded from below. So this canonical thing for higher derivatives is by, I think, Ostrogradsky or somebody did that. Ostrogradsky. In the 19th century sometime. And but anyway, this is why you stay away from hard derivatives normally, is that they're not stable. And you can kind of rephrase the problem. You can make them look like they're stable, but then you could pay the price that they're not unitary. Or the only examples that I know which do not have this problem are things like conformal gravity, where you have a higher derivative action, but you also have a gauge constraint, conformal invariance. And so the unstable direction is one of the, it turns out to be a gauge degree of freedom. So it's not something which is a physical degree of freedom. So there's a constraint in the problem which forces you to live on the physical states all have zero energy. Yeah?
Is What do you assume that the phi a is? You said something about relabeling, but you can relabel the phi a's, you said?
I haven't got to that yet.
What, sorry, what did you say about, like, you can redefine your degree of freedom?
So where I'm going is I'm kind of on a little bit of a tangent here about no tire derivatives. But once we get back to this, you might be surprised with how many parameters we have here, right? We have an n by n matrix, several n by n matrices. Sounds like there's a lot of parameters in that theory. Whereas physically, you're thinking if I gave you n free particles, then they might each have a mass, and then you could have a ground state energy. And those are the only physical parameters you're expecting to find. So you're expecting to find n plus 1 physical parameters, one for each mass, and then the ground state energy. So that means that a lot of these parameters are not really physical. So what I want to do is I want to explicitly do the field redefinitions that removes all the various freedom of these parameters and reduces them down to the n plus 1 that you know are physically there. And that's the canonical form. So in your first field theory course, what they probably did is they just wrote down this canonical form where you have a standard, you know, this, you would have had a 1/2 here, and you would have had a, you know, mass squared here. And what they've done is they've done a field redefinition to get to that point. And I'm laboring the fact that you had to get there by a field redefinition, because when we do loops, we're going to find that the loops will generate terms like this again, which we'll have to then get rid of again. We can always get rid of them, but we have to do the step of getting rid of them. And so where I'm going is that I'm going to use field redefinitions to remove many of the parameters that appear to be here.
Also, shouldn't you also write down some FA times derivative of phi A?
Yep. Well, no. So you mean two derivatives of phi A. It has to be Lorentz invariant. So it has to be Lorentz scalar. So I can't have one derivative because I wouldn't be Lorentz scalar.
All right.
But I could have d mu phi A. So now I'm going to go through and cross off a bunch of these and then redefine the other ones away.
Can I see the middle board of this one?
Okay. All right, so this Lagrangian, so the first observation is that some of these things we don't have to really take seriously, so we can drop total derivatives. So anything of the form d mu v mu in Lagrangian implies that the action is going to be the integral, you know, d4x of d mu v mu. And that's just by Gauss's theorem, that's a boundary. Normal, not the BD. And so that's something which only sees the boundary values of the fields. And so if you're in a problem where boundary conditions are not playing an important role, a total derivative isn't going to be important. And in particular, if you're doing Feynman rules and scattering, that's one of those situations where boundary values are not important. If you actually said, well, the hell with it, I'm going to keep these terms anyway, then what happens is you'll find that the Feynman rule for a vertex that came from a total derivative will involve things like it'll be proportional to something which vanishes because of momentum conservation, say. So in practice, even if you did include it, you're just wasting your time because it's always zero in all the things you're calculating. So that allows us to cross off this one. That's a total derivative. That's it, I guess. I guess there's another one I could have written here, which is I could have written one of these derivatives outside this thing, but I didn't. So, but let me write it just for you. I guess that would have been a linear combination of that and that, so I don't have to do it again. But since I can drop total derivatives, then I can also integrate by parts. So that means this one is actually, I don't need to keep this one separately because I can write this as a total derivative, which I'm allowed to drop, and then plus something like this. So since EAB phi A d mu phi B I can write as d mu of EAB phi A d mu phi B minus EAB and I can drop that because it's a total derivative. That means that this is not really independent of that. And if I had kept them separately, what I would be finding everywhere is that all physical amplitudes were functions only of A minus E. And I never had A and E appearing separately. So it's stupid to keep them both around. So I might as well just not write that one down anymore. We can get rid of this linear term because I can always shift phi to get rid of that term. So choose BA such that there is no term in the shifted phi. Right, so that allows me to get rid of that one if I want to. That might make a difference. You know, if it happens that you're keeping track of symmetries, like in spontaneous symmetry breaking, then the shift is something which is going to be important because that means that the background value V is not invariant in the symmetry. And so that you might care that you've made that shift. But I'm not following that, so. So then we're just left with these three terms. So now, these are not arbitrary matrices, right? So A is clearly a symmetric matrix, right? Because this is symmetric under A goes to B. So there's nothing, if I had an anti-symmetric part here, it would vanish in this thing, and the same thing's true for B. They all have to be real, because our Lagrangian was supposed to be Hermitian. Oh. The A's, the B's, and the B are real. And stability says that A has to be positive, a positive definite matrix. This is coming from unitarity, the condition that the Hamiltonian be Hermitian. So H bounded below requires both, I guess, A, B, positive definite. And I guess it also requires B to be positive definite, or non-negative definite. And to see that, if you take this thing and you write out what the Hamiltonian is, right, this is this Lagrangian, if I write down the time derivatives, you know, it's this is minus AAB. Oh, actually, I'm going to make my life simple if I have a No, I'm good. Yeah. This is phi dot A, phi dot B with a plus sign here. Remember, d mu phi, d nu phi, A to mu nu. If you're not using the right metric, you might have thought there's a sign here. But that's minus phi dot, plus grad phi, because the minus in the metric is in the time part. So that minus sign cancels the minus sign in the metric. It gives you something which involves time derivatives that are positive. Minus AAB. I'm beating this to death for scalars, and I'll do it faster for the spin half and the spin one. because it's the same for them with a couple changes. But right. So now the if I take the momentum would have been derivative with respect to the time derivative. That's 2a phi dot b. And so if I calculate what the Hamiltonian is, that would have been the momentum times the phi dot minus the Lagrangian. And so if I should have put a factor of a half here. But since I did, well, let me put, if you don't mind, I'm going to stick in a factor of half just to make my life easy. Go through there. And then this is, just becomes 1 half AAB. I should have written this in terms of pi's, but I'm going to just write it again in terms of the phi dots. Plus. So you can see that this is a positive definite if these a's and b's are non-negative definite. If these guys had negative eigenvalues, then I could make phi vary in time or vary in space in such a way that I could get as much negative energy as I liked for some configuration. And so that's where the positivity is coming from for a and b. And that's important. So now let me talk about the field definition. So what am I allowed to do? So given that we know what the a's and b's are, what we'll do is we'll we'll redefine in two steps. So first, what we'll do is we'll take phi a goes to a to the minus 1/2 phi a. So I'll take the negative square root of the matrix A, and that's possible because A is positive definite. So if you like, we diagonalize the matrix A, all of its eigenvalues will be positive. So then we take the square root of those eigenvalues and then undiagonalize, and that'll be the matrix we're talking about. So, so this makes sense. Because A is positive definite. And with that choice, then the Lagrangian becomes minus 1/2 delta AB mu phi A mu phi B. That's why I made the choice. Minus 1/2 A transpose to minus 1/2 and B times A to the minus 1/2 AB. So let's call that B twiddle AB. It's still symmetric, because B was. A is symmetric, I guess I don't need the transpose. And I've got that wrong. Oh, yeah, that's right. The question, next question is, can we simplify B at all? And what we want to not do is screw up what we've done here. So this is called this form with the 1/2, and the delta AB here is called the canonical normalization. If you start scaling the fields by some factor, you're going to ruin that, and you'll go back to a matrix A. But that choice that puts you in that form is the canonical choice, and what you'd like to do now is ask, what can I do without ruining that canonical choice? So can still redefine I'm only doing linear transformations here because I'm trying to not ruin the quadratic property of the Lagrangian. But like if I take phi goes to O times phi, where O transpose O is the unit matrix, so it's an orthogonal transformation. Then that transformation won't change this at all. And so I won't have ruined the nice canonical kinetic terms that I've got. So let's use that freedom to simplify B. So under that transformation, then L becomes minus 1/2 delta AB d mu phi A d mu phi B minus O transpose B twiddle O AB phi B D. And now the thing is that this is a symmetric, real symmetric matrix. I can always diagonalize it with an orthogonal transformation. So since is real symmetric, that means it's Hermitian in particular. Can be diagonalized. Being Hermitian means that it can be diagonalized by a unitary transformation, but because it's real symmetric, that means that unitary transformation is it can be made orthogonal. So I can choose O transpose O in such a way that O transpose B O is a diagonal matrix, you know, B1, which I'm going to choose to write as 1/2, you know, M1 squared, M2 squared, M3 squared. These have non-negative entries because B was a matrix which was a non-negative definite. So eigenvalues. And then now it looks like something that you recognize, right? It's so with that choice, L is minus 1/2 d mu phi A d mu phi B delta A B minus 1/2 m squared A phi A phi A d. And I've written it as m squared because if I calculated the Hamiltonian, so if we calculate the total Hamiltonian, which is the integral over time over space of the Hamiltonian density, or the Hamiltonian density you get in the usual way we did before, down there. And if we use our expression for these fields in terms of so phi A of x, if we use them as it's a sum, it's integral d3p. And now I'm going to have to be specific about where my momenta go over the square root of 2 pi cubed twice the energy. So this label A, I'm labeling the particle by, so I've got one for each type of particle. And their particles are labeled by momentum. And so here I'm writing out that thing I wrote where I have a particle piece and an antiparticle piece because of the general causality story. And that's designed to make this phi something which commutes with itself in space-like separation. I'm choosing a canonical normalization here because I'm imagining that if you calculate the momentum state, which is obtained from the vacuum, the conventions I'm using here are that momenta, the orthogonality condition is the one that you're used to from ordinary quantum mechanics. The thing that Matt was referring to earlier on is that sometimes in relativistic problems, people choose a normalization where they put in factors of square root of the energy here to make everything manifestly covariant. And I'm not doing that. And because of that, I have factors like this that are different from what you would see in the first chapter of my book, say. But that's really just pure convention. And as long as you're consistent, you're in good shape. And this choice is related to the commutation choice too. That normally you would have had that A with A star Q is on the right hand side here. With this choice, this just is again just a delta function, P minus Q. if you make a different choice here, you're also making a different choice here. So the standard commutation relations that you would normally make, I'm using the standard commutation relations you would normally make when I make this choice here. But if you plug this into this and do all the integrals, then you get something involving the A's and the A daggers. And it's the usual thing. It's and here E, I should have said, is, so E means it's the usual thing, the square root of P squared plus M squared, where M, I mean this thing here for that particular particle. So with that choice, what you find is that the Hamiltonian becomes a constant, which I won't get into, plus the integral d3p of that energy that we just talked about, sum over A, sum over the different fields of E P A star. And so this is the thing that you know, if I apply that Hamiltonian to those particle states, so H on the particle state is given by, on that particle state, where E, again, E, A, P, the subscript A is just meaning that the mass depends on A, so it's P squared. And C is 1, is why I'm not writing it. That's another convention I'm using here. It's also equal to H bar, it's equal to Boltzmann's constant, that's it. So that says that you could use field definitions to get rid of all but n plus 1 parameters. Those n plus 1 parameters were these m squareds in this matrix B, the eigenvalues of matrix B, and then the number d. And this corresponds to the n plus 1 physical things. So the ground state energy, the energy on the no particle state will be this constant. And that constant is d plus a bunch of stuff involving the zero-point energies of these oscillators, which is infinite. So there's some infinite sum over E, 1/2 the energy. Basically, that this constant is equal to d plus sum over particles integral d3p of the energy, basically, which is diverging. So you think of this is good. The energy is that for large momentum is going linearly with momentum. We've got an integral here which is p squared dp times p for large p. So it's diverging in the large p limit. So that's the diverges but the physical vacuum energy is the sum of that plus that. And so as a preview of where we're going for a lot of this course is that we're going to imagine that this is also, you know, what was D? We didn't know what D was. We would infer what D was by comparing it to some observed thing. The thing we compare it to figure out what its value is the vacuum energy, because that's the only place D appears. So what we really are going to do is say that D is by definition the vacuum energy minus this. And so the sum of D plus this is something which is whatever we measured the vacuum energy to be. And so in that process, the thing we measure the vacuum energy to be is it's something which is measurable, so it's some finite thing. I'm lying to you a little bit here because I should have said that there's an overall factor of the volume of space that appears here, because this is the energy and not the energy density. And because the Hamiltonian is a local thing in position, it'll always come to you, the energy of the vacuum will come to you as an integral over space of the energy density, which will be a constant because it's translation invariant. So the energy per unit volume is the thing that you're expecting to be well-behaved in the limit of large volumes, because that, if you like, that's an infrared divergence. And the energy per unit volume is something which we use to determine the value of D. And so the D we find has to depend on lambda in such a way that the lambdas cancel between D and this to give you the finite value that you did measure physically. And this this is quantum field theory in microcosm, because ultraviolet divergences at the large momentum end, they're always renormalized into the values of parameters that you had to infer from experiment anyway. Once you've traded the value of a parameter for a physical thing that you measured to get the value of that parameter, you will find that that implies that there's an implicit dependence of that parameter on the divergence, which is then canceling it in all other visible parameters. So ultraviolet divergences are things that are renormalized into the values of your constants. Infrared divergences mean you've asked the wrong thing. So if we had asked what the energy of the vacuum was, we would have found it's infinite, even if we'd done this renormalization, because it's proportional to the volume of space. And that's right. That's if you have a translation invariant system, the energy will scale with the size. And so the energy should be infinite. The thing that's physically meaningful to calculate is the energy density, which is the energy divided by the volume. And so an infrared divergence is something you don't renormalize. It just means you asked a stupid question. And what you should ask is a different question, and that will be infrared finite. And so when I learned this course, I learned it from Weinberg as a graduate student. He had this aphorism that quantum field theory is like a Middle Eastern religion. It's cruel but fair. If you ever ask the wrong question, it will punish you. And it punishes you with these divergences. But if you don't ask the wrong questions, then it doesn't punish you, and it gives you these wonderful answers. And so, much of the rest of the term is going to be this in more detail in general, that infrared divergences, ultraviolet divergences are normalized into parameters in your problem. Infrared divergences mean you've asked a question which wasn't really a physical question if you look at it carefully. And if you ask the right question, a physical question, then you don't get the infrared divergences. And that's probably a good place to stop. So for spin a half particles, it's basically the same. The only difference in that case is that the mass, the sign of the mass is something you can also change by doing a redefinition. So if someone hands you the Dirac equation with a negative mass term, you can always rotate the phase of the Dirac equation to get rid of the mass, the sign of that mass term. So, but otherwise, it's really literally the same story. And the same thing's true for the spin one particles, provided you're careful about gauge invariance. So I might just very quickly, at the very beginning of the next class, do the spin a half case just to show you the partial transformations. But then we'll just write down what the quantum electrodynamics Lagrangian is that we're going to be using for the rest of the term. Any questions? Okay, good. So we'll see you Friday.